Donald Trump's win in the Pennsylvania primary yesterday may be even bigger than it looked last night, according to an analysis of the Republican delegates selected in the balloting. And the primary brought an end to the career of a man who's an institution of Philadelphia politics, Congressman Shaka Fatah, defeated in his reelection bid by State Representative Dwight Evans. I'm Tom McDonald, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. Dave Heller is off this evening. Joining me now is our senior reporter, Dave Davies. Dave, let's talk first about those Republican delegates. Pennsylvania gave only 17 of the state's 71 delegates to the winner of the popular vote. The rest, 54 in all, were elected and go to the convention as uncommitted delegates. Does that mean Trump was shortchanged in this big win?
No, Tom, he actually did quite well, but you kind of have to drill into the results to understand that. As you say, most of the state's delegates are officially uncommitted, elected directly by voters in their congressional districts with no indication on the ballot as to which candidate, if any, they favor. But the reality is that a lot of the candidates for delegate were personally committed to presidential candidates, and if they or the presidential campaign they're supporting could tell voters which people on the ballot to vote for, they could, in effect, capture those uncommitted delegates, and it appears the Trump campaign did that very well. I spoke to Joyce Haas of Center County, where the Trump slate of delegates captured all three of the slots there. Haas told me the Trump campaign put out a mailing with the names of their delegates on it.
The mailing was effective because people did carry it with them to the polls. And the Trump campaign in the area had done some robocalls, so I would guess that that also had an effect.
You know, what's interesting, Tom, is that the woman we just heard is the vice chair of the state Republican Party, very well known to party regulars for years. She herself was a candidate for delegate and was defeated by the Trump juggernaut.
Amazing. Dave, any idea of how many of these uncommitted delegates Trump captured?
I went through the winners in these delegate races and found that if you count those who were either publicly committed to Trump or on the Trump recommended slate, which was available online, or had publicly committed to voting for the winner of their congressional district, in most cases Trump, all of those three things are indicators of a first ballot vote for Donald Trump at the convention. That accounts for 35 of the 54 delegates. Now, technically, legally, all of them are uncommitted. They have 10 weeks till the convention. They can change their minds, of course. I asked one of them, Lee Stover of Northampton County, what the chances were she'd vote for somebody besides Trump.
Me? Probably zero. I did, during the time that I was running, I did have two pretty serious calls from the Cruz campaign trying to turn me, but I just said I wasn't interested.
So, Tom, when we add the likely Trump votes to the 17 pledged delegates he was awarded by winning the popular vote, he has 73% of Pennsylvania's delegates, actually more than his percentage of the popular vote.
And late this afternoon, Ted Cruz came out saying that if he wins, Carly Fiorina would be his running mate. Seems a little unusual.
Unusual indeed, but everything about this election year is unusual.
True.
And it's obvious Ted Cruz and Governor John Kasich of Ohio have been scrambling to find a way to keep Trump from locking up the nomination. We had their announcement of an alliance with one another, which, by the way, I heard voters at the polls yesterday said in some cases convinced them to vote for Trump because it seemed like a sleazy kind of collusion.
Mm-hmm.
The Trump campaign will portray this as another indicator of Ted Cruz's desperation. We'll just have to see.
Dave, I have to take a second while I have you here to reflect for a moment on the defeat of Congressman Fatah, who was, of course, running for reelection while facing corruption charges. Give us a sense of his place in the city's political history.
He's one of the titans of city politics for decades. I mean, he ran for his first office in the early 80s when he actually would have been too young to serve. He made his way to the state legislature, then the state senate, and in 1994 defeated another legendary name, the late Lucian Blackwell, to go to Congress. But at every step of the way, he was one of those politicians who didn't just hold office. He built a political structure that supported other candidates for office. He understood how to accumulate power and political leverage.
Now, did he have anything to say today?
I spoke to him very briefly. He didn't want to give an interview. He said it's really a day for the victors. he really has another very serious matter confronting him, and that is his trial on corruption charges. Jury selection begins Monday. He has been predicting for weeks, of course, he would win renomination in the primary and then acquittal in the courts. The election went badly. We'll see now about the trial.
Senior reporter, WHYY's Dave Davies. Thank you.
Thank you, Tom.
Political races, of course, are about winners and losers. But as our commentator and NewsWorks blogger Dick Pullman notes, there are different ways of handling wins and losses. In the case of losing, he thinks Bernie Sanders could learn a lesson from his opponent.
Repeated pummelings, four more losses last night, including a blowout in Pennsylvania, Bernie Sanders still can't find the high road on his mental GPS. He's still steamed that Democrats have the temerity to run Democrats-only primaries. He's not even a Democrat. He says he's going to battle at the convention to the bitter end. Whatever. Perhaps if Bernie is at all interested in losing with grace and class, in uniting with his victorious foe for the most existential crusade of our era, preventing an unhinged racist demagogue from owning the nuclear codes, he will take a moment to read what Hillary Clinton said to her disappointed followers on June 7th, 2008. That primary season had ended 4 days earlier. She had virtually split the nationwide popular vote with Barack Obama, but she fatally trailed in the delegate count. Her delegate deficit was actually far smaller than Bernie's current deficit, but did she whine about rigged primaries? Nope. Here is a small sampling of what she said, and I quote, "The way to continue our fight now to accomplish the goals for which we stand is to take our energy, our passion, our strength, and do all we can to help elect Barack Obama the next president of the United States. Today, as I suspend my campaign, I congratulate him on the victory he has won and the extraordinary race he has run. I endorse him and throw my full support behind him. And I ask all of you to join me in working as hard for Barack Obama as you have for me." End quote. That's the way to do it. You face reality and eat humble pie for the greater good. So the big question is not whether Bernie is toast. He's losing the national popular vote by 57% to 43%, which in electoral parlance is known as a landslide, but whether he stands down in a graceful manner. Right now, however, we're getting mixed signals. Tad Devine, a strategist in the Bernie camp, signaled the press early yesterday that his candidate is prepared to reassess. But the Bernie camp is still indulging in juvenilia. Yesterday it sought new donations by emailing a photo of the Clintons at Trump's wedding. So we'll see which way Bernie plays it. As an outsider, a Western European-style socialist who merely caucuses with the Democrats, he's comfortable with defiance. On TV the other night, he insisted that it's incumbent upon Hillary to make the first move toward winning over his fans, which is quite cheeky, given the fact that she's the winner and he's the loser. On the other hand, Bernie has been an inside-the-beltway politician for the past quarter century. Despite all his self-righteous thunder, he knows how to do deals. He hinted as much the other night on MSNBC when he said, "I will do everything in my power to make sure that no Republican gets into the White House in this election cycle." So if he wants to stay in the race through California, fine. And if he stops trashing Clinton on the stump, that's when we'll truly begin to know whether he's doing everything in his power to kill the Trump poison before it fatally infects this country. This is Dick Pullman.
Dick Pullman writes a national interest blog on newsworks.org. While they were here for Pennsylvania's primary, Sanders and Clinton left their marks on more than just national issues. They both weighed in on a very local topic, Mayor Jim Kenney's controversial proposal for a tax on soda and other sugary drinks. That got WHYY's Katie Culinary wondering how it could shape the debate going forward.
It all started last week when Clinton was speaking at a church in North Philly about ending the school-to-prison pipeline. Clinton segued into saying she's, quote, very supportive of Mayor Kenney's proposed 3 cents per ounce tax on sugary drinks.
Know. We need universal preschool, and if that's a way to do it, that's how we should do it.
Later that day, Sanders hit back, calling it a regressive tax.
You don't have to fund childcare on the backs of the poorest people in this city.
The candidates cut to the heart of the local debate, whether the tax would hurt the very people it's designed to help. So now that Clinton and Sanders have moved on to other states, will this episode be just a blip on the political radar or something more? One way these statements could live on is through TV ads. Kevin Feely is a spokesman for Philadelphians for a Fair Future, the nonprofit formed to promote the proposed tax.
I can't speak to the specifics of TV ads at this point. All I can tell you is that it's a great boost to us, and people should expect to hear more about it.
Larry Seisler, who represents opponents of the tax, says he appreciates the validation from Sanders, but doubts it'll make a difference to the body that'll actually decide, Philadelphia City Council.
The most junior member of City Council has more of a say on this issue than either Hillary Clinton or Bernie Sanders. And there's really nothing that they said in those statements that, you know, either the voters or City Council has not heard.
Seisler doesn't think it'll make a big difference outside the city either. But Philadelphia isn't the only place in the country considering taxes on sugary drinks.
I think I got an email. It was like, Larry, you got to hear this.
Larry Tramutola is a consultant in California who's working to pass soda taxes in San Francisco and Oakland, two cities known for their large progressive voting bases. And unlike Philadelphia, the fate of those initiatives will ultimately be in the hands of voters, not city council members. When Tramutola heard about the presidential dust-up in Philly, he got concerned.
Having the industry now being able to use Bernie Sanders' words for their own behalf could potentially be a problem. Now, will it be a problem? I don't know, but there is that potential.
With the California primary coming up in June, there's a chance the issue could come up again in the national media, right around the time Philadelphia City Council is expected to vote on the proposal. Katie Culinary, WHYY News.
Still ahead, news and politics today are full of chatter about the global economy, and we often think of it as a modern development. Now an exhibit takes a much longer view, looking at international commerce in the 16th century.
This exhibit really is changing the way we look at history, and I think none of us is as myopic as we were before we were made aware of this show.
A visit to Winterthur coming up as NewsWorks Tonight continues on WHYY. On Thursday night, the Philadelphia School Reform Commission will vote on a series of high-stakes decisions, including whether three district schools should be converted into charters. The decisions will be based in part on the district school quality yardstick, known as the School Progress Report. Joining us now to talk about some of the reasons to be wary about relying too heavily on the SPR is WHYY education reporter Kevin McCrory. Welcome, Kevin.
Thanks, Tom.
So you've been poring through the numbers. What did you find?
A large degree of inconsistency. SPR gives its greatest weight to student progress as opposed to raw achievement.
Now wait, what's the difference?
Right, so achievement is just how well did you do on the test. Progress is how well did you do on last year's test compared to this year's test compared to everybody else in the state. And if you look at 3 years of SPR data, you'll see that the largest chunk of schools have been moving both up and down on progress tiers, meaning, for instance, that 1 year a school is rated reinforced for progress, which is the second highest tier. The next year it's rated intervene, which is the lowest tier. And then the next year it shoots all the way up to model, which is the best tier.
So why is this happening? Couldn't it just be that the schools are wildly more or less effective each year?
That's possible, but there are a few other things to consider. The district has been adjusting the way it calculates its scores. So when I presented officials with my findings, they acknowledged that year-to-year comparisons shouldn't be made, which isn't something they've been saying publicly. And in fact, this year's reports featured a longitudinal plot line of year-to-year performance. So at the same time they're saying don't compare years, they're showcasing that year-to-year performance. Where this gets really frustrating for the public is that what this essentially means is that sometimes when the plot lines show progress, they really do reflect progress, but other times they don't. And if you don't pore through the reports with a deep understanding of the metric, you'd be left really confused and misled. For this reason, School Reform Commissioner Bill Green has been advocating for more stability in the tool.
It's not fair to the schools to not lock it down at a certain point. And it's sort of hard on decision makers and policy makers when you have a score, but the underlying reason for that score is shifting.
The district's chief performance officer, Jura Chung, who created the SPR, pushes back against that logic.
It's a trade-off, right? Do I keep the tool constant for the sake of longitudinal analysis, or do I enhance the tool because I think these changes are making it better and giving us a better snapshot of school quality? So I don't want to give up one for the other necessarily, and so I can commit to minimizing the changes. I can't guarantee that we'll have no changes from here on out.
Now, Kevin, the state test that students take became much more difficult last year. How's that affected the data?
I asked Chung that question, and here's what she said.
A new, harder test could have influenced the growth metric, but it doesn't invalidate the growth metric. It's a factor. I don't know how much of a factor it was.
So without making any definitive judgments, some of the data that I crunched offered some unexpected results. Specifically, it found that schools with the lowest math proficiency rates in 2013-14 had a much greater chance of getting positive growth scores on the next year's test. In theory, there should be zero correlation between raw proficiency and growth, but the numbers here suggest a deeper look.
Now, Kevin, at the beginning, we talked about high-stakes decisions that the SRC will make tomorrow evening. How does all this factor in?
Right. So to be absolutely clear, SPR rankings are just one piece that leaders look at when they make decisions. But when there's questions about the metric, it undermines the public's understanding of how these decisions are made. And in this case, where sometimes the appearance of progress is real and sometimes it isn't, the entire debate becomes clouded.
Hopefully we'll see some sun shining through those clouds.
Thanks, Tom.
Thanks, Kevin. WHYY's education reporter, Kevin McCory. The Winterthur Museum and Garden in Delaware is hosting an exhibition on the world's emergence as a global economy. From WHYY's Arts and Culture Desk, Peter Crimmins reports America was not at the center of it.
In 1492, Christopher Columbus was looking for a way to get Europe closer to China when he accidentally stumbled on the Americas. That expedition became the start of a new trade network. Furniture, textiles, and decorative objects made in China or Peru or Spain were crisscrossing the oceans in the 1600s and 1700s. Made in the Americas, The New World Discovers Asia is a traveling exhibition from the Boston Museum of Fine Arts. It's now at Winterthur. Museum director Tom Savage says the American colonies were just on the fringe of this.
This exhibit really is changing the way we look at history, and I think none of us is as myopic as we were before we were made aware of this show.
The hub of international trade at the time was Mexico City. This show features textiles of Chinese silk woven with silver thread mined in Central America in a pattern traditional to Mexico. There's a Christian nativity scene made of Chinese porcelain for the international market because very few Chinese were Christians in the 16th century. The show was curated by Dennis Carr of the Boston Museum, and Savage says Carr found a dresser inlaid with mother of pearl in a Far Eastern design, but it was made in South America.
It had been miscatalogued as an Anglo-Indian piece. But when Dennis saw this piece, he immediately recognized it as coming from Peru. It's insanely rare, insanely beautiful, clad in this rich mother of pearl. The whole thing just shimmers.
Savage included some of Winterthur's own collection into this show, including dressers made in Boston in a Japanese style and pre-Revolutionary War porcelain in a Chinese style. I'm Peter Crimmins, WHYY News.
Finally, given the dismal state of Philadelphia sports, it may have escaped your radar that the NFL draft begins tomorrow night in Chicago. And while most football players entering the draft are evaluated on such categories as strength, agility, and 40-yard dash speed, one local prospect is receiving some jeers for another critical aspect of his game, his cooking ability. Voorhees, New Jersey native and former Ohio State cornerback Eli Apple is projected to be a first-round pick as long as his perceived culinary ineptitude doesn't affect his position. An anonymous football scout recently told the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel that he worries about the 20-year-old Apple's life skills, specifically that he, quote, can't cook. Apple's mother denied the accusation, noting in a tweet that Eli's father is a retired five-star chef, and Apple himself claims to be one of the best cooks on the team. There's a moniker to be proud of. It's certainly a relief to know that after he intercepts the ball for a touchdown, Apple will be able to take off his pads, put on an apron, and fry up some dinner for his teammates, because you know NFL franchises can't afford to make meals for their players. That's all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Binyakov and Kimberly Haas. Find us on iTunes or listen back at newsworks.org. Thanks for joining us. I'm Tom McDonald for NewsWorks Tonight.